that was Charlie Mingus and the Mingus Big Band with Moanin'. They don't sound like they're moaning, are they? That's a very different version, another tune entirely, different from the one by Art Blakey and his Jazz Messengers. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It's Wednesday, December the 5th, and today, the first of an extended series of conversations with attorney at war, Alton H. Maddox Jr., one of the most important figures, I think, in the story of contemporary civil rights struggles and grassroots empowerment in the city and state of New York. That is not, in my estimation, an exaggeration at all. It is as an attorney at war that Alton Maddox has made an extraordinary contribution. And it is in this capacity, this very capacity, that he has paid and continues to pay an extraordinarily high price. Still undaunted, he perseveres, continually organizing the community through the United African Movement, which is based in Brooklyn, and which continues the work in the Garvey philosophy of taking care of one's own. I can tell you from personal experience, I say all the time that I have never seen anyone in a courtroom who operates with such precision than Alton Maddox. And I've been covering stories involving Alton Maddox going back many, many, many years. I'm delighted, Alton, to have you with us today, and welcome. You there?
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you, Alton. Thanks for being with us today. I want to start at that point of your profession, because you paid a very high price for the work that you had done and continue still to do in a different capacity, but still very much on top of things in monitoring the law and most often the misapplication of the law. But 25 years ago, your license was suspended, not by a bar association, not by a lawyer's committee, but by a state legislature, the legislature of New York State. And to my understanding, that has never happened anywhere in the United States. What is the status now?
Well, the status then was 5 years suspension, and then a reinstatement to the practice of law. And it seemed as though I was handling that so well that the state decided without any notice to me that it should upgrade the status from suspension to disbarment. And I received notice that I had been disbarred from legal papers that had been filed in opposition to my action for reinstatement. And in those legal papers, the New York State Attorney General advised the court that I was not a suspended attorney as I had claimed, but that I had been disbarred and that now it was discretionary as to whether New York would reinstatement or not. It was not a reinstatement after 5 years, after I had been suspended in the first place. And so now, as you indicated, in addition to the fact that the initial suspension was as a result of a bill of attainder filed by the New York legislature and prosecuted by the New York State Attorney General's office, now there has been a disbarment, which means that I have no right to be reinstated to the practice of law. And although there have been no allegations that I had done anything after the original illegal suspension to have warrant the upgrade to a disbarment.
What was the basis of the suspension?
Well, the basis of the suspension really was nothing, because the state legislature was not my client, and I had no matters in which I was beholden to the state legislature. So when the proceeding initially started, it was just simply the state legislature saying that the New York State Attorney General's office should look into my conduct, particularly with respect to the Tawana Brawley matter. And from there, the New York State Attorney General demanded that I come before it and the disciplinary committee and to tell them everything that I knew about a client that I was presently representing in a 67-count indictment. And I cited to them that this was absolutely a violation of the attorney-client privilege, even if you wanted to assume that there was some basis for the disciplinary action in the first place, and that I would absolutely not be cooperating with it. And the New York State then used that as a basis for my suspension, that I would not cooperate with something that really never existed in the first place, and something that would in fact violate the attorney-client privilege.
Now, up until the point that you were suspended, you had not committed any infraction at all. You had not committed any crime. You had not done anything that would be considered injurious to your client. Mm-hmm. But the state arbitrarily said, I remembered the Attorney General at the time, Robert Abrams, saying, in effect, in explaining the move against you, was that you, quote, embarrassed the state of New York, unquote.
That was his allegation, that over a period of time that I engaged in certain conduct that was embarrassing to the state, and that my continued practice of law posed a continued threat to everybody in the state, and therefore some action should be taken against me.
But now, I searched around, but I didn't find any evidence of an instance in the United States where an attorney was either in any way sanctioned, whether suspended or disbarred, by a state legislature. Is there such a thing, or did I do my research right?
Well, you did your research right, and fortunately, it has been kept to a minimum in that I'm the only person that I know who has been subjected to that. I will direct people to the U.S. Constitution, in which the, quote, Founding Fathers, close quote, wrote a document that said that they did not want to return to those experiences in England, one of which was a legislative body filing a complaint against another person, and that under the separation of powers doctrine, that is something that should be unconstitutional in this country. And as a result of that, there's a provision in the Article 1, I believe it is, of the U.S. Constitution, in which said there can be no bill of attainder. And apparently New York felt as though that was the only way that I could be stopped. And so it resorted to unconstitutional means. And I mean, and that is so clear, and you know, anybody that want to check the public record can always go to the New York State Attorney General's office or to the courts and ask to look for the file automatics, and they will find no complaint from any client, and they will find no evidence of my ever being convicted of a felony or a misdemeanor or any other infraction that will warrant this action.
At the time that this occurred, what was the response from the, well, since the legislature was the one that moved, the assumption is that African-American legislators also moved. Was that the case?
Well, obviously I was not there in any discussions. But later, when I brought it to their attention, meaning some of the black legislators, they claimed that they were unaware that any such action had been taken, although they were aware that I had been suspended, and although I did direct them to my files, disciplinary files, as you would call them. And there was no evidence of any warranted action, but nonetheless, everybody got rumnesia, as I call it now, given this last debate, and nobody never made any fuss of it. And so it has just been there for more than two decades as an unconstitutional action.
What has been the response either from the Black Lawyers Association or from the American Lawyers Association?
Well, you know, the response from the Black Lawyers Association has been very tortured in that I, you know, brought this to their attention, and at one of the annual conventions a little bit more than a decade ago in Philadelphia, you know, I asked them to put it to a vote. Could I get support from the National Bar Association? And initially, they were somewhat hesitant. And eventually, there was substantial debate. And the debate started on a Monday of the convention. And by that Friday, it was unclear whether they were going to even support a resolution, and when it did hit the floor, it was a vote of something like 51%, 49%, and that they would support it by a very slim margin. But every president of the National Bar Association since that time, and this has been more than a decade ago, has refused to sign the resolution. And so, in effect, the vote was nullified.
But you still are proceeding with the case in terms of challenging the decision, or have you just decided it's not worth fighting anymore?
Well, that's been sort of periodic. You know what has happened, Utrecht, as some people may note, I've never felt as though the legal profession was the one-all and be-all in terms of what I did to sustain myself. And I have not only practiced law, but I've been very active in a lot of other things, some of the things that you mentioned already on this broadcast. And so from time to time, you know, I have resorted back to challenging it. But otherwise, I have just continued to do things that I thought was very important for our community. And in many ways, you know, some of those things have been successful. I haven't been in any way stale and dysfunctional or unfunctional for any period of time. And so I would have to say that, you know, it is something that is still on my radar screen, but I'm just not thoroughly preoccupied with the notion of me personally being reinstated to the practice of law. I think what is more important is that we as a people, you know, proceed in a certain way And I think also it's important that my practice of law really was designed to redefine the practice of law in terms of black lawyers and to also redefine the issue of representation of black defendants. And I found none of those concerns in any law school and in any legal experience that I ever had. And so I was embarking on something that was new. I think that when you look at the prison industrial complex, and I think you look at a lot of the conditions of our people, what you would find out is that in many instances there really is a question of misrepresentation, and that is not necessarily intentional in some respects, because the law schools just don't equip black law students to learn about how do you represent a black defendant in the criminal justice system as opposed to a white defendant.
And I'll get to that in a minute. I have to say this, DeLalton. It is a disgrace. It is just a disgrace on the part of the legislators, on the part of professionals in law, in the practice of law, that this unfair action and illegal action was taken against you and nobody spoke up. It's a disgrace. We had a black governor who certainly was empowered to do something about it. He did nothing. We have all those black legislators who supposedly are very concerned about the plight of their constituents when it comes to the application of the law. They have done nothing. And you, who have been in the vanguard of a lot, if it weren't for you, there would be a lot of people sitting in jail right now, including Al Sharpton.
Well, that's true.
But I
think that what it indicates, and a lot of people in the audience may not know this, but I really have also represented a large number of the black legislators before I was disbarred. And in all of those instances in which I represented them in one area or another, it was always pro bono. So when you consider the magnitude of the work that I did in New York, and to find that everybody is afraid to open his or her mouth is really shocking.
You went up against the Catholic Church and won. You went up against the federal government several times. I remember I covered those trials myself and won. The Tawana Brawley case, which everybody is still saying is a hoax, many people are saying that. I, to my knowledge, am the only reporter who ever reported on the basis of her medical files, which said she was raped. All of these cases you've taken on, and I might add, at no cost.
Well, I think one thing that you just pointed out, and this is a bigger issue in terms of our community, is that we don't really consider the fact that there is no free press in our community. When you was editor-in-chief of the City Sun, it was more or less an exception to the rule. And I think that we have to be really concerned about the rule, which is a free press, what does constitute a free press, and the fact that until you have a free press, among other things, there can be no freedom. I think that we just dismiss certain concepts and feel like we're still moving on to freedom when you can't move on to freedom when all of the conditions necessary for freedom are missing.
Is there something that people can do to register their displeasure about the fact that you have been deprived of the right to practice your profession? Is there some some letter that could be written, something that could be organized, or is this something that you even want done?
Well, the one thing, and you know this from years ago, I've always felt as though one of the problems that we as a people have in this country is a lack of political leverage, and that we are engaged in the practice of plantation politics. And I go back to Reconstruction, in which Senator Charles Sumner of Massachusetts, who was then a Republican and was in the vanguard of the legislative struggle for black equality in this country, stated that black people, upon given the franchise, should not join the Democratic Party, and that they should not join his party, the Republican Party, but they must form their own party in order to have some semblance of justice and freedom in this country. Unfortunately, to this very day, we haven't really taken heed of what he stated. And, you know, we've had a pretty good shot at it here in New York in 2010, but we ran into some snags, more or less, from people that look like us. But I think that really, overall, to answer your question, is too many of us in too many different places, especially in places like New York City, where we hold a balance of power, political power, in this city. And we also spend more money in this city than anybody else, that something is wrong when we can be as abused as we have been for the last 400 years.
So I get back to the question. Is there something that people can do to register their concern that you are not allowed to practice your profession by an illegal act of the state government?
Yeah, and I think the answer is that the statement that Adam Clayton Powell made, what's in your hands, goes back to the dollar and goes back to the vote. And I think that both of those are going to be have to be exercised properly in order for people to take note. You indicated earlier that Governor Patterson had an opportunity to do the right thing, and he didn't. And I've known David Patterson for decades. But when he was in the executive branch of government as the governor, he failed to take any action. And I think that any gubernatorial person certainly has the power and the authority to correct this injustice. As a matter of fact, I was somewhat surprised one day when I was in the United States District Court for the Southern District of New York, and there were several people there with me, and we were arguing a motion. And the U.S. magistrate stated that the only way that my condition is ever going to be corrected is through the legislature. And, you know, I can file as many lawsuits as I want to file, but this is the political reality. My case falls outside of the judiciary, and it goes back to politics itself. I was really shocked that she said it. I don't know why she said it. Maybe it was just a moment of honesty on her part. But it was said, but I think that's really where it boils down to. It started outside of law, and obviously going to have to be corrected outside of the law.
You're listening to Lee's Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lee. The guest is Alton Maddox, Jr., an extraordinary man and an extraordinary professional. And I'm delighted to have him here today. Alton, I did ask you to make some room because this is an extended discussion and there's a reason.
Uh-huh.
One is I want to be able to fully present you, because I think many people misunderstood you and many people still have some very jaded ideas about you. They don't know what I have seen, and they don't know what I know about you. But more importantly, I think the community needs to get to know you, because although you are in New York City, you have had a much larger impact. And I've seen those cases in which you have done an extraordinary job. And we can get to some of those cases, many of which, by the way, in legal terms, have set precedence in law, because your practice of law is so different. I mean, so many, I remember the late Bill Kunstler used to tell me, he said, man, any case with Alton Maddox in it, I want to be in the courtroom observing it, because your courtroom style is just extraordinary. I was there that day when the trial for Al Sharpton opened, and within a matter of, it was even under 20 minutes, you had gotten rid of about six key so-called witnesses. And in that trial, he walked away from in excess, I believe it was 68 counts against him, and without calling him to the stand. So in a matter of the practice of law, these things ought to be known. But I want to talk to you also because your practice of law is inextricably linked to a much deeper motivation. And that motivation has to do with the plight of African Americans in the United States and the history of injustice, the bifurcation of the criminal justice system, the misapplication of the law consistently when it comes to people of color in the United States, and the law that yields entirely different results simply on the basis of race. Could we get from you an idea of where this drive came from and what sustained it for the times that you were in the practice of law?
Well, I think that the drive that I may have developed probably started in my childhood in Georgia. I was, a rather precocious child with some moderation. I got an opportunity to really start school about 3 years of age. And this was during Jim Crow in Georgia, actually in the late 1940s. So you can imagine the kind of facilities that we had in terms of going to school, which was just basically real minimal. I could see, as a child, that our plight, really needed a lot of attention. And I was personally experiencing it myself, and I suppose because I started reading at a very early age, by the time that I was 6 years of age, I was reading about the Korean conflict and things of that nature, and I remember this one opportunity I had. I was visiting my aunt in Atlanta. I live in adjacent county to Fulton County, but I was visiting her, and there was some NAACP documents there. I believe that the NAACP itself was holding its annual convention there that year. And I started reading these documents, and I ran upon the case of Mary Turner. And this was a woman in South Georgia who was pregnant. Her husband did not return home one night. The next morning, she went up to the sheriff's office and asked about what happened to her husband. She had heard rumors that he had been lynched, and they told her that, he was uppity, blah, 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 and that she, going to learn to live without him. And she then threatened to go to the FBI. And that night, the sheriff brought a posse out to her home, and she was pregnant, and they drug outside, and they found a tree, and they built a fire and hung her. And then somebody noticed that her stomach was protruding, and so they said, well, she's pregnant. And somebody said, well, get a knife, and they slit her stomach, and the baby fell out into the fire, and they stomped the baby and lynched her. And I suppose from that moment on, I could just never lose sight of that. And it didn't make matters any better because conditions in Georgia did not improve, and so you saw all these other instances of injustices that, you know, by the time I got ready to go to college, I was, you know, convinced that I wanted to practice law and to really try to use my talents and skills to try to improve the plight of our people. And I think that that just became a burning desire that I had, and I just never lost it.
1-888-874-4888 is the number to call with your questions or comments for Alton Maddox. 1-888-874-4888. Well, what are you concentrating your efforts on now?
Well, at this particular time, the things that I think are very important for me is to, as Kwame Ture noted before he made his transition, and he was personally talking to me, that our people really need a political education, that there's so much that we still lack in terms of politics, in particular, certainly in terms of law and in terms of economics, and that, you know, without that political education, we just always be caught out here in the trenches. So I think a large part of what I try to do is around that. And I think that, you know, there have been several institutions that we have built, organizations to address some of those problems. One, the United Africa Movement, which was started in 1988. And has had several successes of its own for people in the New York City area. They can remember the time when at the heyday of the United African Movement, we were at the Slade Theater in Brooklyn and were there for maybe nearly a decade until the Giuliani administration brought legal actions against us. And although we won the legal actions, but then people began to be fearful of what they thought we were doing. And so we've always had a hard time trying to maintain a permanent home since the Slade Theater, but we still do the Wednesday night forums. Back in that, its heyday, we were bringing in people from the four corners of the world. To some of the leading scholars and activists and lecturers and authors and others to really give our people here a really firm sense of their history and their politics. I think a lot of that made a lot of difference. But as I said before, we also had so many battles, and New York is not as progressive as a lot of people think. Part of it is because white people put a lot of money into the city just to make sure that we don't progress. You can't be in an environment around Wall Street and around Madison Avenue and don't think that people are not concerned about what you are doing. And so that has been a real problem that we've had to face over those years. We've had the Freedom Retreat for Boys and Girls, which we ran for two decades, in terms of bringing our young people upstate every summer. And we've had a tremendous success there for the two decades that we ran this. And our last year was just this past August. And during that time, we've never received any notice of any child that's gone through this program who's ever been arrested, convicted, and sent off to prison. I don't think there's nobody else who could establish a better record than that. In terms of that, in 2010, we had the Freedom Party, in which the minimum required number of signatures was 15,000 to get on the ballot. We accumulated over 45,000 signatures, and then when the vote was counted in November, the city all of a sudden and the state mysteriously lost 190,000 votes. And obviously those 190,000 votes was ours, and so we've been fighting that as well, because this will be the first time ever in the history of this country that we ever had a political party with ballot access. So we clearly know how to do it. It's just a question now of being able to sustain that struggle and to mount all opposition to it. So that's been one of the other things that that we have, you know, have done, and so big issues in terms of our constantly staying involved in many of the issues that affect people, especially the area of police brutality and things of that nature. So there's been a lot to be done. I think that we've set a model. I think that people who really want to study our condition in this country, you know, will certainly want to look at what we've done here in New York with the United Africa Movement, with the Freedom Party, with the Freedom Retreat, with the many years of pro bono litigation that we waged in this city, and really try to build on that and improve that and to sustain it.
I've heard some people say about you that you seem to be fixated on this issue of race. Mm-hmm. What's your response?
Well, my response is that they're absolutely correct, because everybody else is fixated on it. You know, I mean, when other people let up, I will let up. You know, but I can't let up and go somewhere in La La Land when the main reason that we've been here for 40 years and one of the main afflictions that we've had to suffer was that of race. You know, I don't have a natural inclination to be addressing racial questions, but if race becomes the number one item on the list, and it seems as though when you look at the prison industrial complex and you see the overwhelming majority of the people in the prison industrial complex are black people, when you look at the failure of school systems and you look at a disproportionate number of failures of those of black people, and when you look at even legal cases like Brown versus Board of Education, where it explained to some extent why those things existed, I think that anybody who was oblivious to the issue of race is out of his or her mind. So I don't make any apologies for that. I'm just going with the flow, and right now, race in my mind is at the top of the heap. Now, if somebody can convince me that there's something other than race at the top of the heap, then I'm willing to listen. But right now, I got to deal with what I see and what I feel and what I hear and how I'm hurt, and it all evolves around race.
Well, of course, this is the first of our conversations that we'll be having. Because I think there are a number of cases that we need to take a look at that you've done because they set legal precedents. We want to get to your legal work. But I'm dealing now, we're talking about, you know, what shaped you, and we're talking about what drives you and what your vision is. What is your vision for the work that you do and will continue to do now?
Well, you know, one, you know, my vision has really been shaped, you know, by our ancestors. I'm not doing anything that has not been entertained before. You know, I'll give you an example. At the end of his life, Adam Clayton Powell sought to form the People's Party. This was at a time when New York said that Charles Rangel had defeated him, and he began to form the People's Party. Well, he died right after that. So when I come in and start talking about the Freedom Party, I'm not talking about anything new. I'm just trying to carry on the work of those who have come before us. You know, when I go into courtrooms and start litigating cases, this is not something that I started. It's something that Charles Hamilton Houston, for example, built an institution around in order that black lawyers should be in the vanguard of the legal revolution. You know, I came to New York City as a poverty lawyer, but Adam Clayton Powers started the issue of the war on poverty. I believe in organizations that are black-led and black-financed, but I wasn't the first one to say that. I mean, Marcus Garvey said it. Adam Clayton Powers submitted a 17-point plan in the congressional record. And in that plan, he indicated that black people would have to have black-led and black-financed programs. So to the extent that people have problems with me is the level of ignorance that they have of their own people and their ancestors and what that vision has been. And I'm just simply one of those persons who's trying to carry that out in the same way that the Tea Party is pursuing the objectives of Thomas Jefferson and Andrew Jackson. I mean, that's just the way life works. And if you're out there and you don't have a vision of what your ancestors embraced and what they were trying to pursue, and when they leave what your job should be as someone who is walking in their footsteps, that's where the problem lies. And so that's the way that I see it. I'm just one of those who believe that you have to be in tune with your ancestors and that you have to carry on that work. And even that work means being assassinated, as Mega Evers was in Jackson, Mississippi, for trying to make sure that there was public affairs programming for blacks and that the media would put its attention on Mississippi. And ultimately, he had to pay the price for that. That's what you have to do. But I think we have to become disciplined within what those who have come before us have required, and they are now requiring of us.
What should white people think of you?
Well, you know, I'm really beyond, you know, controlling what white people think. I hope that there are people out there who are humane enough to understand that when you're at the bottom of the heap and that the only thing you're trying to do is to come above board, that, you know, they will have some understanding of that, and that they will also have understanding that all humans like to stand on their own feet and not use other people as crutches. And I think that if white people understand that, and I think that any white person who is human would understand that, then I don't see the problem with what we are doing, because everybody is standing on their own 2 feet, as they should be, in this kind of society. And it's nothing anti-white because you don't want any crutches and that you want to walk on your own. I mean, you know, and that's sometimes why people have some misunderstanding about me or some ambivalence, because, you know, their reaction is, well, you know, you don't want to use white crutches. And I'm saying, well, you know, I mean, why should I use anybody's crutches, you know, when I can basically walk on my own? And so I really never really think about what other people think about me, you know, and I don't really use that as any kind of measuring stick as to whether I should continue to move forward or what I intend to promulgate, because I think I am on the right track. And I think that for those who do understand, they will, and for those who don't understand, they won't.
Well, you made a reference to the elected officials before.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any faith that the caliber of leadership will improve, especially in the communities in which you do your work?
No, under the present system, I don't have any faith, because the vote itself is a powerful means of expressing your concerns. given that it is a powerful means of expressing your concern, and given the fact that we have really literally went 100 years in terms of getting the right to vote after the Emancipation Proclamation, if you believe that Lincoln freed the slaves, I think that the reality of it is that there are always ways that people are employing to dilute the vote. We've seen voter suppression, voter ID laws in the past. We've seen the white primary system, which was supposedly ruled unconstitutional in Smith versus Allwright, which is back in 1944. But the reality of it is, even to this day, especially here in New York City, given the fact that we are all addicted to the Democratic Party, ultimately, we don't select the people that represent us. We only elect them. They're selected by others. And given that system, I can't have any faith in it. And that's one of the reasons why I've spent so much time saying that we do have to follow the advice and lead of men like Charles Sumner and others and have our own institutions to express our own political views.
Reggie from New Jersey, you're on with Alton Maddox.
Good afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you.
I have to really say that Alton Maddox is the icon of many developments. His work is just unparalleled. O.J. Simpson had Johnny Carson, but the regular person has Carson, yes.
Cochran.
Yes, thank you. But Johnny, but regular people have Alton Maddox. And from seeing what they've done to him, I'm a separatist myself. I was moved there, and I have nothing against white people, but standing on our own 2 feet are very important, just like the professor said yesterday. And even though there's no place to go, I think that the idea of us being independent away from this economic and political slavery that we have that's exhibited in Alton Maddox's life, I think that in order to be free, we have to get our own minds to the point where we understand that if we stay here under these conditions, we'll be slaves all our lives, and our children will be slaves. So we have to really negotiate, perhaps create some programs. The programs that he ran are beautiful, but we really have to say that, I guess, you know, looking at Alton Maddox's life, if we can't put him back to what he deserves, if his life can't be rectified, then all the discrimination that we all go through will continue forever. One person should be a symbol, and Alton Maddox is that symbol because he was a lawyer that defended so many black people during a time when it was before they took over, really, and came out with the face of the courts. Now you see the face of the courts. And Alton Maddox stood against the face of the courts for the common person. So we owe him a lot, and if we could, should repay him, he should be the first person because his mind is correct, and we need a leader. The image that he has is very on time.
Well, thank you, Reggie, for your comment. That brings us almost to the end of our program today, Alton, but we proceed tomorrow with the – we get into nuts and bolts tomorrow with the practice of the profession and the cases that you have done and the legal precedents set in those cases. But we'll also talk about tangential issues having to do with organizing for the next – not just the next leg, but the next generation. And this, you mentioned Kwame Ture. He talked about the need always to organize a community, and our communities are really disorganized at this point. So I want to thank you, Alton, for being with us today and giving us this nice little window into what your thoughts are and how you operate. And we'll be back here again tomorrow, same bat time, same bat channel. Thanks so much for being with me today.